This is Car Expert.
The Polestar doesn't necessarily do any one thing better than any of them. But what it does do is blends together the conventional and the reassuring in the sense that you service it at a Volvo dealer.
We're a country of 27 million people. So 50,000 charging stations in homes. I mean, what dent can that make?
Sportage, it's just a critical model and they're really trying to shake things up. So it's quite an exciting car.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. G'day, Tony Crawford.
Mandy, how are you?
Really, really well. How are you, Jack Quick?
Hi there, Mandy. Good, thanks for having me.
Thanks, as always, for joining us. Now, Crawford, you've got a giant smile on your face because you've been driving a very expensive Ferrari.
I have. The expensive Ferrari, first of all, was $1.4 million on the road. And, of course, that is currently the Ferrari SF90 Spider. The Stradale came out in 2019. I had the Spider for a total time of 4 hours. Supposed to be two, but we kept it for an extra two.
Oh, good.
Did you steal it for the 2 hours?
As you do, as you do. Like, where's that? I was trying to film my walk around and got people saying, we need that car back. And it kept stopping the video because I didn't have Do Not Disturb turned on. So I had to restart the video.
Oh, I said, yeah. No, that's a nightmare.
Anyway, 1,000 horsepower, 0 to 100 in 2.5 seconds, 0 to 200 k's an hour in 7 seconds flat, and top speed of 340 k's. And of course, it is a hybrid, the SF90. So it has a twin turbo V8, and it has three electric motors to give it some welcome boost up to that 1,000 horsepower.
Wow.
And, 2.5 seconds, by the way, is very, very close to what the original Bugatti Veyron did top speed. I think that was 2.4 and, 400 plus. But this is a the big takeaway from this is that I thought it'd be a very remote car for Ferrari to drive, but in fact it was incredibly seamless and still provided oodles of feedback through the steering wheel. The brake pedal, in fact, is brake by wire, and I had more feel than I've had in other Ferraris of the past. So work that one out. I couldn't because it had a beautiful pedal feel and great progression, seamless transition of power if you're driving in hybrid mode when the V8 kicks in, and just extraordinary amount of poke off the mark, and virtually, of course, no lag with that hybrid system at all. Not that Ferraris have any lag anyway, even their normal twin turbos. They seem to have mastered the technology of eliminating turbo lag from their turbo cars.
How does it sound?
I think it sounds good. Alboz reckons it sounds pretty crap compared to his 458 Speciale, but
of course it's better.
But I actually think it sounds really good. I mean, look, it sounds as good as it's going to get these days. And we all know, look what's happened to Formula One cars. They've gone from a screaming 19,000 RPM down to about 11,000 RPM or less. So you don't have that insane Formula One that you would get on a flat 12 like the 812 Superfast. With a naturally aspirated flat 12, but I think it's stimulating nonetheless. And, who doesn't want a car with 1,000 horsepower? In fact, tragically, I got into an RS5 press car and it honestly felt incredibly slow, and I really wanted that 1,000 horsepower. It's amazing how quick you get used to horsepower or kilowatts.
That's so cool. Are you doing a review on it, or can we see any content?
I am doing a review on it, probably later this week. Next week I'll get to do that, if not quicker. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Here is this week's news. Sam, we'll start off with you, Jack. You've written a report about how the Nissan CEO has outlined next generation GTR, except that do we really care? Because we might not get it here.
Yeah, it's interesting because we've only just seen the GTR leave Australia and they're talking about a new model, and I'm feeling a little sad because we don't have the current model anymore. Mm-hmm. But Nissan CEO Makoto Uchida has been talking about the so-called R36 Nissan GTR. And he confirmed a couple of different things, and they're still working on a lot. As far as I'm aware, it's just all a lot in the future at this stage. It's just initial talks, but he said that it's going to be riding on a new platform, which is exciting because the current GTR has been around for a while. I am fairly certain, I want to say 14 years, 15 years, yeah, something like that. A long time. I want to say 2007. I think that's correct anyway. But the thing that is going to be interesting is it's going to be potentially electrified. What that means is your guess is as good as mine, but there's all sorts of different things that Nissan could be doing. It could be some sort of mild hybrid system. It could be a plug-in hybrid, or who knows, and it would be controversial, could be fully electric, which would be interesting because it's Nissan's flagship model, the GTR. It's Godzilla. It'd be all electric Godzilla. It certainly sounds like a good headline, but it'd be interesting to see. But I don't think Nissan CEO would want that. He's actually said that he wants to create the fastest super sports car in the world without a hybrid system. So he thinks that he can do it without a hybrid system, but electrification is going to have to happen at some stage in order to keep the car competitive with all of the emissions regulations that's going on worldwide. And as I talked about just at the start, we've only just seen the current model R35 GTR leave Australia due to Australian ADR 85 side impact regulations, which means it can't be sold anymore, similar to the Alpine A110 and a slew of other cars as well. As I said, we're not certain when this new model is coming at all, but the GTR did go out with a bang with two special editions, the GTR T-Spec and the GTR Nismo SV. Both of them picked up some cool little exterior aesthetic tweaks and a few performance tweaks as well in the form of like a performance exhaust. Nothing too flashy, but something just a final hurrah for the R35 GTR. And one thing with this new R36 so-called GTR that the Nissan CEO is making sure is absolutely paramount, is it's as in throughout history as well, but most for this new generation, is going to be different from the upcoming Nissan Z. So which makes sense because they wouldn't want crossover, seeing that they're different cars. But he wants particularly with the Nissan Z to be more of a cruising car, whereas the GTR to be like full performance. The I almost think of it like the Gran Turismo, and you fully max everything out and you're like a rocket ship. But totally. One thing I would love to see, we kind of got a bit of a preview with the current model-ish sort of. I'll get to it. But with this new R36 model, I'd love to see little snippets or maybe inspiration from the GTR 50 by Atal Design. It was, you might remember, it was just this crazy limited production, super crazy R35 GTR. And I think that'd be super cool to take aspects from, have little bits of electrification and make it one of the, bring it back. Bring it back. I want to see a new GTR. I don't know when it's going to be happening, but it's going to be fast when it does happen. And as you talked about, Mandy, it'll be interesting to see if it does come to Australia. There's nothing confirming about any of this just yet, but we'll have to see. Watch this space. The Nissan Z is coming, so that's a given. But GTR maybe at this point. What are your thoughts on this new potential GTR, maybe going hybrid?
What do you reckon, Crawf? You love your performance cars.
I do, Mandy, but I'm a bit confused. So he wants it to be the fastest super sports car without a hybrid system. Is that right?
Yeah. So,
but in the same line, he's talking electrification.
He's kind of being pulled in two different directions. So like He wants electrification, but he also wants the internal combustion to be the main statement of the car. But it'll be interesting to see what actually happens. There's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, so multiple conflicting reports with maybe electrification, maybe not. all sorts of different things. Yeah, I'm sorry it's a bit confusing, but we just have to watch this space, I suppose.
I don't think you could possibly have the world's fastest super sports car unless you had some form of electrification or hybridization
at least,
of something.
Now, yeah.
These days, because, I mean, you know, I don't know.
How many brands that are doing it?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a tough thing. Their engine was so good that produced so much power, that old six-cylinder twin turbo, that it'd be hard to sort of walk away from that basis and come up with something fresh. I just don't see how you would do that if he's saying no hybridization and then not wanting – and then talking about electrification,
It's bizarre, yeah. We'll have to see. Yeah, it's conflicting at this stage, Watch this space, I suppose.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, Croft, the government is going to be funding electric car infrastructure, but there's no sign of any subsidies, though.
No, there ain't no subsidies, Mandy.
I love how you're laughing about this.
I read all the comments in the story by William Stofford, and people are calling it the one that struck me was it's a fizzer, I reckon that's right. I spoke to a friend of mine at BMW this afternoon when I knew I was talking about this story, and he made the look. What they want to do is they want to amp up the charging infrastructure, but that doesn't mean people, because there is charging, that are going to go out and buy EVs, because it's still an early adopter technology. Very few are sold as in the scheme of things. I was looking today, and you're able to buy only 22 different electric vehicles, and only three of them are under 50 grand, and the rest of them are 65 right up to, Porsche Taycan, which Gran Turismo, which will cost you, upwards of 300,000 for the Turbo S. And so, look, I still think if you want to get people buying electric vehicles, you need to make them parity with ICE engine vehicles. And the US is geared to see parity with ICE versus electric vehicles in 2025. They say we might get there by 2027. That's still, not so long away, I guess, 6 years away. So I just think charging is one thing, and they're gonna do that with the private sector. I think to not offer any incentives to get people into these things, the way the federal government did it with solar panels in the 90s, where they were offering quite substantial subsidies for people to buy either, I think it was 6 panels or 9 panels. And instead of paying $10,000 for the 9, you paid 3. And for the 6, you paid like 1 instead of 3. So, although the vast majority of people that have taken up solar panels, this is the analogy, have probably come well after that incentive disappeared. Because of the view on global warming and the fact that everyone does want and does see the benefit of us going electric. But what they're saying, the sample sizes of 50,000 charging stations in homes. Well, we're a country of 27 million people. So 50,000 charging stations in homes, I mean, what dent can that make? I don't know. Like, that seems to be ludicrously low in my book. And the government wants 30% of annual new vehicle sales to consist of, some form of electrification by the year 2030, whether that's EV, hybrid, or pure EV or plug-in hybrid.
We can only hope by then, Croft, that the prices of EVs might come down a little bit to make it a little more attractive for people to buy.
I just think that the vast majority of EVs have got to be, under 75. Well, look, they've just raised the luxury car tax from, I think, 77,560 to 79,659.
Oh, have they?
Something like that. I mean, it's 2 grand effectively, but
it still
least
makes a Land Cruiser luxurious, doesn't it?
it's something. I, I, um, My colleague, a friend of BMW, made a very interesting point where he said New South Wales is so far ahead of the game. So away from that federal government initiative and on to the New South Wales government, they're investing $595 million into getting people into EVs. But that's an enormous amount of money. And that's probably what it's going to take. And I've heard of all sorts of incentives that are coming in New South Wales, whether that's free parking, free transit lane stuff, you know, the really good stuff that people can sink their teeth into and think, yeah, that's a reason to buy an EV, to travel in the transit lane and or offer subsidised or free parking at certain areas and free charging within the city or wherever you need to go. So I do get that you do need the infrastructure because it's you're no good planning a trip if you need to really sit down and, okay, we've got to stop here for 2 hours while we charge. And I guess that comes down to the level of EV that you purchase. And if you're paying a lot of money, you'll probably get fast charging. And we've got to rely on people like Hyundai and Kia and those and Nissan for that matter. And even Mitsubishi with their plug-in hybrid Outlander that just has arrived. And it's a little bit more expensive than the standard Outlander, but, you do get to partake in that lowering of emissions in the world. And I just think it is a bit of a fizzer when you look at this effectively and drill down into the detail. And they're using private money as well. So it's not like they're investing a whole lot of taxpayer money into this. I don't know what you guys think about EV sales, and would you buy an EV now? And you know, where most EVs we talk about now are 70 to 90,000 dollars, which puts it well out of the grasp of the average family. I mean, to give you an idea, that you buy a car for around $57,000, you'll be on about a five-year lease, you'd be paying about $830 a month. So it's a fair bit of money. And I think, cars beyond that puts it well out of reach. And, to get to that parity where they are mirroring ICE engine prices, I think is the holy grail of when the take up of EVs is going to be significant rather than, 1 or 2 or 3% of the annual sales of the country.
Just one on the happy side of things. I read a story earlier in the week about one of these EV charging partnerships as part of this Future Fuels Fund in the round one scheme of things. I know it's, as you've talked about, Tony, it's not what we wanted, but it's something in the grand scheme of things with a little bit of infrastructure, and I'll get to my point. One of the companies that we're lucky enough to get funding for charges, they've partnered with Hungry Jack's, which aptly named
really?
For me. I remember when I was younger, I used to love Hungry Jack's. I was like, oh, this is my store. Anyway, I'll get back to my point. So they're investing, and they've started this partnership with a charging station at Hungry Jack's with the main target of you can have something to eat while you're charging your car, and good for delivery drivers. But I thought that was quite contradictory when writing it, because I've been in so many different like Ubers and ride sharing and had delivered a lot of Uber Eats and stuff like that. And I haven't seen any of them have an EV. I've really only seen like Camry hybrids or like 10-year-old Holden Astras, blah 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 blah.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing. I reckon this would maybe make sense on like large fuel stations on the way to certain places, like to Adelaide or to Sydney or you name it, wherever. They've got big hopes, but I want more. I want EVs to be cheaper. I want some more incentives. I just want more. It's not, I sound like a spoiled brat, but I was like, it's just not fair.
I think there'll be a lot of people agreeing with you there, Jack. Now, we're going to move on to the next one. This is actually really exciting news. Lincoln Co., it's official. It's coming here, Jack.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting indeed. So Lincoln Co. kind of sounds like a deodorant company. It sounds like Lincoln. It's first question, what is it? So, yeah. So it's very funny how it all works like this, but Lincoln Co. is under the Geely structure. So Geely currently owns or partially owns Volvo, Polestar, Proton, Lotus, London EV Company, the company that makes the taxis for in London, like the, you know, the iconic ones, Smart, and then also Lincoln Co. And Lincoln Co., sorry, I'm just getting sick of repeating. Lincoln Co. is the youth-oriented brand. It's they're trying to be cool, trying to be edgy, have it look a little bit different. So that's what they're going for. And in particular, it's coming to Australia. So we've got something to awesome. Look forward to, I guess. So mainly we already have a lot of these brands here in Australia, Volvo, Polestar, stuff like that. But yeah, another brand, it's going to be saturated with you name it. It could be not really certain what car is going to be coming yet, whether that's internal combustion, electrified or pure EV cars. We'll have to see. But it's coming nonetheless. And this was all in what Geely is calling its Smart Geely 2025 strategy. So in this, Lincoln Co. will expand its global presence by entering Russia, Malaysia, Australia, and New Zealand by 2025. So they've got some big goals planned, and the reason for this is they want to boost their sales, I think, to around, through the entire Geely group, to around 3 million and something annually. So they've got some big things planned. It's going to be interesting once it comes to Australia. I'm interested.
So much choice,
I'm intrigued.
Isn't there?
Yeah, there's. I think it's almost too much in the sense that there's numbers and then there's blah, 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 and I can even tell by just thinking and thinking back what I've just said myself. I'm like, that was a lot of numbers and just didn't really make sense. So I hope when it comes to Australia, they've got something clear and they do something, and it's going to be an exciting time. I'm looking forward to it.
It reminds me of Cupra, like that style of thing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, very
you
true.
You know, like it's a bit of a Cupra play. They're pretty cool looking cars, these Lincoln Company, although the comments, if, I don't know if you've read them, but one person says it sounds like a gourmet ice cream shop. One person says it sounds like a trendy cafe in my area, which is actually shite. I remember wearing Link shoes to school. I mean, there's a lot of comments, but look, you know, proof will be in the pudding, of course. So let's hope they look pretty cool. So
hope they can back it up. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And lastly, Croft, BMW Australia are temporarily selling cars without a touchscreen function.
Yeah, not as bad as it sounds, I might add, but it only affects approximately 200 cars across a number of series, 2 series, 3 series, 4 series, Z4s, X5, X6 and X7 models that won't have touchscreen functionality. So they'll have the screen there, but you won't be able to actually touch that screen and change anything. You'll have to rely on the iDrive rotary controller, which, you know, at the end of the day, we used to all do that and we all loved iDrive. In fact, when touchscreen came in, we sort of were remiss about losing the iDrive controller on some vehicles. So when you have the I think the fact that we can use the iDrive controller, which works better on the run anyway. I don't know if you've had to try to push a touchscreen on the run at some stages. It doesn't quite work at various plays when you're on the throttles, but it does work when you can sort of not have to look at the screen and just sort of twirl this thing around and press the shortcut buttons that are on the pad beside the rotary or the iDrive controller. So I don't think it's a really big issue. They're going to cut the price of these vehicles by about $800, or you can choose to wait further for the and this is all about microchip shortages, right? Semiconductor shortages. So that's all this is about. and or you wait until that car's available with the you can't retrofit it. That's the big takeaway from this is if you go with the discount and you've taken the money and run, you can't come back for another bite at the cherry. So so you'll have to effectively, and I think you miss out on reverse cross. One of the ADAS systems, the reverse cross assist, I think, you don't get that with this functionality. So that probably, reversing assistant without touch capability and reversing assistant.
Yeah, that's the cool one where you can,
traces
you.
Yeah, exactly. And then it can retrace
your.
Which is a pretty cool feature, but I must admit, I haven't used it since I tried it in the latest X2.
I'll give you a lot of trust in the car.
Yeah. It steers it in there, basically. So you still work the brake pedal, I think. But I don't think that's a big issue, guys. I really don't think, you know, if you want to save yourself $800 and just use the iDrive controller as we once did not so many years ago, by all means, go for your life. I think a lot of people, though, younger people have been brought up on touchscreen technology. With iPhone, and then cross-pollinating that into their car, and of course, cheap cars have touchscreens now, so that may be an issue for the younger population, but certainly not an issue for a lot of people. I think I'd basically wait if I could, and
just people would too, I reckon.
Get the whole technology right, because $800 isn't a fortune.
Yeah, exactly. All right, that wraps up this week's car news. It is so great Australia finally has some choice with electric cars. And to make your life even harder, the Polestar 2 has landed here after some great overseas feedback. Scott Colley has driven it and is here to tell us what he thought of it. Hello, Scully.
Hello, guys. How are we going?
Very good, thank you. Before we do get stuck into this, let's just go through the most common question is, what is Polestar?
That is a really good question, and it's one that I got a lot in my 2 days with the car. Polestar was a Swedish racing team in the 1990s. They used to do really hot versions of Volvos for the Swedish Touring Car Championship, which is every bit as Swedish as it sounds. If you look up some old photos and footage, it looks fantastic. In the 2000s and the 2010s, it became a tuning arm for Volvo. So it went from making performance parts to actually becoming like the AMG of Volvo. And it's now been spun off into its own brand under the Geely, which is the Chinese company that owns Volvo, under the Geely umbrella. So under the skin, the Polestar 2 is a Volvo. It uses the same CMA platform as the XC40 and the C40. But Polestar is its own brand with its own retail presence, its own online sales, and eventually a more differentiated product range as well from Volvo.
Okay. So whereabouts would it sit in terms of the EV range or the choice we have in Australia? And maybe the first model that comes to mind is the Tesla Model 3.
So it's interesting. It doesn't really neatly fit any one vehicle segment. If you look at the photos of the car, it looks a little bit awkward, the proportions of it. In person, it's really good looking, but it is kind of it's got like a muscle car roofline with a coupe hatchback sort of sloping tail at the rear and then a little SUV ride height to free up more space for the battery. The Model 3 is probably the closest rival to it. And based on its basic starting price, the Polestar is pretty much bang on with the Tesla. $59,900 and $59,900 for both of them. But you do need to add some options to the Polestar to get a full suite of safety and driver assists. And once you do that, the range starts at $65,000. So still reasonably affordable relative to some of the other electric cars on the market, but also not quite Tesla matching. The car that I drove was the long range dual motor, which starts at $69,900 before on-road costs. That undercuts the Volvo XC40 Recharge Pure Electric, which actually it shares its powertrain with, by $7,000. But the caveat on that is once you add the three Polestar option packs to it, and our car had all three added, it actually had a list price of just under $90,000 before on-road costs. And that's Tesla Model 3 performance money for a car that doesn't quite offer the same performance.
Do you think there should be an option pack that should come standard in it?
It's funny you ask that, Mandy. I do. So Polestar's rationale for selling this car the way that it does is that it does its sales model everywhere in the world, and that is you get the basic car, you choose your powertrain, and then from there you can choose as few or as many options packs as you like. The three packages are quite interesting, but the one that really should be standard is the pilot pack. It's $5,000 across the range, and it gets you adaptive cruise, pilot assist, which is Volvo or Polestar's active steering on the highway, a surround view camera, side parking sensors, blind spot assist, rear cross traffic assist, and fancier LED headlights and fog lights. So none of that stuff is essential, but for one, Polestar's a new brand in Australia, and if it really wants to represent good value, making people tick a $5,000 options box to get stuff that's standard on the XC40 Recharge doesn't really make sense to me. But also, Polestar is trying to cash in on the fact that Volvo is a brand known for safety. It's using Volvo bits and pieces. You're servicing at Volvo dealers. And I think that if you want to take the good of, you know, using Volvo's reputation and trying to link yourself to that, then you also need to actually walk the walk by offering all that safety equipment standard. Realistically, $5,000 isn't going to break the bank for the people who are buying these cars. And I understand there'll be some people who don't want them, but it just feels like a bit of a miss from Polestar, which could have been even more value packed, or even if the car had been $5,000 more expensive and had it all in there, could have made life a bit simpler for buyers.
Scott, you said that it's puts it close to the, well, it's dearer than, well, just under the Model 3 Performance, but the Model 3 Performance can do like 0 to 100 in 3.2 seconds. What is the Volvo's best effort?
So the Polestar will do it in 4.6 seconds. So it's not slow. I mean, that is Volkswagen Golf R acceleration. And the way it does it is typical electric car. It just shoves you in the back and there's no, you know, no brake in the acceleration because there's no gears. But yeah, it's off what the Model 3 Performance can do. It's actually slightly behind what a Model 3 long-range all-wheel drive will do as well. I think it's 0.1 or 0.2 seconds off that from memory.
Right.
I also think it's worth mentioning, though, at some point, 3.3 seconds and 4.6 or 4.7 seconds kind of feel the same. This won't crush your chest like a Model 3 Performance will. I've driven a Model 3 Performance and it's like it's eye-popping the way that it accelerates. But by the same token, most of the time you can't actually dip into that extra performance the Tesla has. And so most of the time the Volvo doesn't feel any slower because the acceleration's just the Volvo, excuse me, the Polestar. Mm. The acceleration feels just as instantaneous. When you're doing 60 Ks an hour and put your foot down, there's no gear changes. It just goes. Yeah, on paper, it's not as fast. And there are people who are going to want everything the Tesla offers. The Polestar can't match it. And on paper, the Tesla is better value because of that. But I do think in the real world, you're not losing a heap by going the Polestar because it's just so fast all the time.
Do you think the Volvo buyer is my question is, when the GT EV6 comes out, which is supposed to do 3.5 seconds 0 to 100 and offer all the luxury you could ever want, do you think that would be do you think that would be a consideration for that Volvo buyer, or do you think the Volvo buyer is a niche player?
I think what Polestar has done really well with this car and what its brand represents is quite interesting. There's a really interesting spread of electric cars in Australia as of this year, and the Polestar, which I'll get to when we talk about the drive as well, doesn't necessarily do any one thing better than any of them. But what it does do is blends together the conventional and the reassuring in the sense that you service it at a Volvo dealer. It drives with a very limited learning curve. You can just get in and go. It blends that sort of approachability with a new, sexy, interesting brand and a style that really is quite unique on the outside. Jack, I know you were with us when we were talking about this, but the Polestar is essentially a Volvo concept car brought to life. And in person, it has this really interesting presence about it that a lot of people commented on when I had the car at an electric charging station, on the street. People actually asked what the car was, a lot of turned heads. So I think although on paper what the Kia offers might be different, might be better, the Polestar is going to sort of fit into a little niche there where there are people who want something cool and interesting and a little bit different. They want to show off they're eco-friendly, but they're also not willing to make the leap to a Tesla and go for a brand they've not dealt with before. And I think that is where maybe the Kia won't be able to match it, is that it's still a Kia, whereas the Polestar does have a bit of a mysterious cool factor about it.
Hmm. Absolutely. Getting back to driving impressions, what's it like driving around the city and once you're up to cruising speed?
So, I mean, for one, it's electric, which I know sounds like a really obvious thing to say, but having not driven an electric car for a while, every time I get back in one, I'm reminded of the fact that these things are so smooth and so quiet and so talky. I love driving manual cars, noisy cars, stupid sports cars, but after a long day at the office dealing with Jack's rubbish, I'm joking, Jack's a delight to deal with. But after a long day at the office, when you just want to get home and you don't want to think about anything, you just want some good music on the radio, these electric cars are unbelievably relaxing and quiet and comfortable because of the fact that there is no vibration or noise. In the city, the Polestar is really nicely calibrated. You get in and there are a couple of different settings for the regenerative braking, but the standard one is perfect because it allows you to do one pedal driving. So you lift off the accelerator and it starts slowing down. But it also doesn't feel like you have to adjust too much to how that works. After a couple of minutes behind the wheel, you're really tuned in to how the throttle's tuned and it just feels very natural. I think in keeping with the fact that this is meant to be a sportier sub-brand than Volvo, the ride is a little bit firm, but it's not harsh or uncomfortable or crashy. It just feels kind of purposeful. Our tester also had, as part of an $8,000 performance pack option, a set of Ohlins dampers, and they have 22 different adjustable points on them. The caveat being that you can't do it using the screen because they're not electric. You have to actually jack the car up to adjust the dampers. Wow. It's not an options box I'd be ticking because Brembo brakes in an electric car don't really make much sense given we're not going to track it. And I genuinely touched the brake pedal twice in the 2 days I had the car. The rest of the time was regen. But also that most owners aren't going to bother fiddling with the dampers. They're just going to leave them as they are. The good news is they were set on a middle setting. I spoke to Polestar about this, and Australia has actually opted for a more comfortable setting than a lot of European markets because our roads are, how do I put this diplomatically, not good in a lot of places. And the ride really works quite well. Having driven a car with the Ohlins and without the Ohlins dampers, I wouldn't bother because there wasn't a huge difference between the two. And unless you plan to actually lift it up and crank it all the way up for when you want to go fast and then drop it down and be relaxed when you want to cruise, it's just there's no tangible benefit.
But what about the gold bits? It has all like the I know that it's nothing flash, but for $8,000 you get gold bits, you get gold brake calipers and gold seat belts. I want to quickly explain as well. This is the first electric car that I've ever been in. I didn't get a chance to drive it, but I was in the passenger seat, in the back seat actually, and it was crazy and weird and bizarre and all the things that Scott explained just before. But I don't know. I understand exactly how you wouldn't want to jack it up and adjust it all yourself with whatever you're using, an Allen key, this, that, or the other. It's just silly. I don't know. It's very manual in a futuristic car, and I don't quite understand it. Yeah, the gold bits. Yeah, I'll go back to the gold bits. How cool.
The gold bits are really cool. And I do think that Polestar is trying to carve its own niche, and you don't establish what your brand stands for by tiptoeing up to it. You've got to lay down a statement of intent and say, this is what we are, this is who we are, and this is how we're going to be that. I can respect the fact that Polestar is a racing brand and these Ohlins dampers are a very deliberate and mechanical nod to where they've come from. So as a statement of this is who we are as a brand and we recognize our racing heritage, I can kind of understand it. But I think in the real world, the way that they're set up and the fact they're part of an $8,000 options pack just renders them irrelevant to most people. And yet, Jack, the gold bits are really cool. I agree. The gold brake calipers look awesome. The gold seat belts, I actually didn't love because if you're wearing a black shirt, it makes it look like you're wearing a Richmond jumper. And I don't know if I can deal with that. But yeah, there's some cool factor to it, but I wouldn't be bothering
not
with
for $8,000. No, yeah. Thank you.
No. Lastly, Scully, could you quickly just take us through what the cabin looks like?
The cabin looks like the coolest Volvo you have ever seen. On paper and in the pictures, this looks kind of like a Volvo interior. And it can be a little bit cruel to some sub-brands that journos sit in these cars and go, oh, that's Volvo and that's Volvo and that's Geely. And because most owners won't do that. But the good thing for Polestar is that even if you do go through it with a fine-tooth comb and look for shared parts, it has a really distinctive character all of its own. The materials are really interesting. They're recycled in a lot of places. They have interesting textures and finishes and that sort of thing that really burnish the fact this is an eco-friendly car. And the infotainment on it is really clever as well. It's Google Android Automotive, which is different to Android Auto because it doesn't run off your phone. It actually runs off Google natively in the screen and the display. It means you're able to use Hey Google commands to talk to your car and get information when you're on the move. It means you can download apps like Spotify or podcast apps directly to the car rather than having to connect your phone up to it. And theoretically, it also means that as Volvo and Polestar keep developing their software, you can use over-the-air updates to keep your car fresh as well. Our time with the car, Polestar is still young in Australia. It's still getting set up, and the internet connectivity was a little bit patchy. Our understanding is that's being fixed, and not everyone had the same problems. So I completely believe that by the time the car actually gets to customers, that will have been fixed. But the Google tech was really, really slick and easy to use. It looks fantastic. But yeah, the full review on that's going to have to wait until we can drive a car where the connectivity is working perfectly. The other thing worth mentioning with the interior is that up front, it's really comfortable to sit in. It's got those beautiful sculptural sort of seats that most Volvos have. But storage is quite limited. The center console has a big sort of rising shape to it, which is partly meant to feel sporty and is also partly a nod to the fact that under the skin, this car shares its bits and pieces with petrol-powered cars that have a transmission running through there. And when you get in the back seats, there's a big transmission hump on the middle seat. There's limited leg room and it all feels a little bit tight. So I suppose in the sense of Polestar going for a sporty and slightly selfish feel, it actually ticks that box really well. But given it is the same price as a Model 3 or very close to it, you've got the Hyundai Ioniq 5 around the same price point as well. If practicality is your main concern, then this isn't necessarily the electric car for
you. You should have seen me trying to get into the back of the Polestar 2, especially behind Scott's driving position. Just before I get to that too, getting into the car, I was like, oh, okay, right. I have to get into this space. The door wouldn't quite open quite far enough for me, and then I couldn't quite get in with my feet, and it was quite tight, I would say. And the transmission tunnel was enormous. So it was somewhere that you'd want to sit in the front, I'd say.
It definitely is noticeable with cars like this where compromises have been made. And for Polestar, the focus is really on giving the car a unique style and also, you know, making it feel a little bit special and sporty. And that's come at the cost of the size of the rear door, which sounds like a really strange thing to notice, but you do notice trying to get in through a small gap as opposed to a big one. And it also has come at the cost of a bit of that rear seat practicality. I personally could live with that. I mean, the way that my life works, I don't have kids to put in the back, so I'd be able to put up with that. If you do want to use the car as a daily driver, Polestar is going to do a national road show and let people sit in the car, touch the car, drive the car. It's just one to test out, because if you can deal with it and you like the rest of the car, it's great, but there are more practical vehicles out there.
Yeah, fantastic. That review is live now, and you've given it a car expert rating of 8.2. Thank you, Scott Colley.
Thank you, Mandy. I'll also say that Mike has given a separate variant a rating of 8.3, but our thoughts are pretty much otherwise aligned. So make sure you check out both the long-range all-wheel drive and the long-range single-motor versions to get a feel for how the range stacks up.
Now, there's always a brand of car we have a connection to when we were young because it was the choice of our parents. For me, it was Mazda. And for James Wong, it was more specifically the Kia Sportage. Hello, J-Wo.
Hello, darlings. How are we doing?
So you must be pretty excited about the 2022 model, right? And I'm assuming your parents might be too.
Yeah, so every new Kia launch seems to prick my ears up a little bit because, you know, I've had quite a lot of experience with Kias in my past. My parents have a couple of generations old Sorento and Sportage, and the Sportage actually was my car for a little bit before I became an automotive journalist and started driving press cars and bought my own Golf and everything. So I am quite attached to the brand and some of its cars. So this new one has caused quite a stir, I think, mainly because of the design, but also just when you think about how competitive and how important the mid-size mainstream SUV segment is, not just in Australia, but globally at the moment, it's not just a big launch for someone like me who actually, you know, follows and cares about the brand. I feel like it's a pretty big launch in general because it's just a critical model and they're really trying to shake things up. So it's quite an exciting car before you even sit in the driver's seat.
So is this an all new car or
generation.
Is it or generation, I should say? Yeah.
It's new from the ground up in the sense that they've thrown out all the old stuff that was in the old one. The old one was based on an older architecture. I think it was pretty much like an enlarged Serato or i30 platform, whereas this new one gets the new, I believe it's called N3, N for Nathan. It's the same platform that underpins the Tucson, the Sorento, the Santa Fe, the Staria, and the Carnival. So instead of being an enlarged small car like many small and medium SUVs are, this is actually a shrunken large one. And as I'll go into in a little bit, it actually really transforms how it drives and how it feels in most aspects of what an owner will put it through. And obviously just the size of it itself, it's so much bigger. And Australia actually gets the long wheelbase version globally. For the first time, Europe did its own versions of the Sportage and the Tucson. So Hyundai and Kia in Europe sort of operate as their own entity. They have a couple of bespoke models. They do their own development. And so they have a slightly shorter wheelbase for the Tucson and Sportage that suits the local tastes, whereas we get the Korean and US body, which is much longer, offering a lot more legroom in the back. And the boot has grown by like 85 liters or so, and it's now a class leader rather than just being an also ran. It's quite impressive. And the design itself, it affords new technologies. There's a potential for hybrid, although they haven't confirmed it for us yet, but there is a self-charging hybrid available from the Korean factory, which hopefully we'll get our hands on soon. We've sort of heard rumors that it probably will come, but they haven't heard anything official from Kia just yet. And it just means that, you know, all the really cool screens and driver assistance technologies that we've seen from various new models from Hyundai and Kia on this platform are, you know, available either higher up in the range or as standard. And it's in terms of features and equipment, it's very competitive. They've managed to keep the pricing as well fairly competitive given all the new stuff in it, and since the entire industry is sort of just moving up in terms of price these days. So I only tested the GT line as part of the launch, so unfortunately I haven't really sat in or driven one of the like the naturally aspirated front wheel drive petrol or the diesel just yet, but I'm fresh out of the turbo petrol or wheel drive, so ask away.
Well, before we do get into the driver's seat, and I know a little while ago, Crawf, you did a walk around video of it. What did you think of the design in person?
Myself? Oh,
For Jawa first, yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
It's not about you, Crawf.
No, I wish it was.
Well, I was quite conflicted about it at the beginning. When they first revealed the images, I wasn't sure if I was really a fan of it because it's very distinctive and very out there. They've sort of gone down the route that a company like Lexus has, where they try to be very distinctive and very angular and very like alien looking. And I sort of preferred the classic look of the previous generation, particularly my parents' one, which was that sort of cutesy bubbly one with like the sharp headlights. But seeing it in person, and the car that I'm testing is in this really nice silver metallic, it's just a really, it sort of comes together in person. And it's something that I've started noticing recently with a lot of new model launches. It must be something to do with like studio lighting and computer generated images that sometimes make these designs look a little bit awkward, but it really does come together in person, and it just looks really cool. The proportions, it's got a very like low roof line externally, even though there's heaps of space inside. So it sort of has this almost coupe-ish raked roof line, and like the tailgate's really like sharply creased, and the way that the boomerang LEDs at the front give, like, it almost got like this alien stormship looking signature to it. So it really does come together well in person. And I think the GT line with the black mirrors and the big wheels and roof racks and all like that, and the chunky bumpers, it really does look quite substantial and muscular. And it's like a nice, it doesn't look too manly, it doesn't look too feminine, for example. So I feel like it will appeal to a lot of people. And I've actually got a lot of friends and family members that are either putting down deposits on them to order already, or they're interested in buying one. So it's been really interesting to sort of hear feedback from people that aren't necessarily car people or in the industry, because, you know, for me, I'm very vocal about what I like and don't like, and that's not always what the feeling of the majority. But it's been really interesting to see how widespread the appeal is. And, you know, my parents really like it as well. They might end up buying one too, who knows.
Wow. Is there, I'm assuming there's a bit of a price difference between the previous gen and this one now?
Yeah, there's a few grand in it. So in GT line spec, it's about $3,000 or so more than before, but you do get a new engine that's turbocharged, you get a much bigger vehicle, you get a lot more technology and equipment, and obviously the design is a very big step forward, both inside and out. So it's a big jump, yes, but I feel like it justifies that and then some, especially when, you know, this GT line petrol is $51,990 drive away. Whereas the equivalent Hyundai Tucson with the same engine in Highlander guise is, I think, 50,000 dead plus on-road costs. So it's about 54, 55 drive away. That's a pretty big difference when you think about it. And then when I did like the competitor list, a lot of other vehicles in the segment, that they top out like around the $50,000 mark before on-roads, or they're well into the 50s once you factor in on-road costs. So it's still, relative to the segment and its competitors, it's still very well priced and very well specified.
Jay, well, just a quick question. I've done a big walk around, but I've not driven one. I've noticed the power figures and torque figures on anything but the diesel are quite low. How does it pull that extra heft and size of that vehicle compared to the old way smaller vehicle?
Yeah, so while the old one was quite a bit smaller, I don't think the weight penalty is that different. And in terms of, I can only speak for the turbo petrol because that's the only one I've driven so far, but it definitely feels more muscular and more effortless than the old naturally aspirated 2.4 that was in the previous GT line. And my experience with the Tucson, which is essentially the same car, it is a lot more effortless than the base 2-liter petrol front wheel drive. I think what people will need to know, and this is one of the few criticisms that I have of it, is that the 1.6 litre turbo, while a decent engine, or actually a good engine in some of the smaller vehicles, say like Cerato or Kona or Seltos, once you get to this size of vehicle, it's very much a, you know, it's adequate, it gets along fine, it's probably better than some of the naturally aspirated engines in some rivals. I did come out of a rival SUV with a naturally aspirated 4 and a CVT, which I can't exactly talk about yet, so I won't tell you what it is, but it definitely feels better than that. But another criticism is that the dual clutch transmission combined with the somewhat adequate power outputs means that it just can be a little bit lethargic off the line, and it doesn't feel particularly fast. It just sort of, it's a little bit better than average, but it's not like a standout in any way. And I think that would potentially push me to recommend the diesel for anybody that's doing a lot of country touring or wants a bit more performance, because the diesel has more power and more torque and has a regular 8-speed automatic, which is likely to be smoother in stop-start traffic.
100%, but it's also, you mentioned torque. It's got 400 Newton meters as opposed to like 195. So it's, or 220 in the case of the
265 in the turbo. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, 400 to me for a vehicle of that size is where you want to be, right?
Absolutely.
I would have thought.
Yeah. And it's a shame that we haven't had confirmation officially of the hybrid just yet, because the hybrid has 169 kilowatts and 350 Newton meters, which is much closer to the diesel in terms of torque and then also has more power. So if they can bring that one to Australia, I reckon that'll be quite popular, not just for the economy, but also the performance benefits as well.
Well, I think with that vehicle, with the closed hybrid, they'll be able to compete directly with RAV4.
Absolutely.
And really give it a shake up there, because RAV4's really had it to themselves.
Yeah, and continues to do so.
Yeah, but I think for me, the looks and design of that Tucson and the interior, particularly the GT line, would win me over, probably over the Toyota big time.
Yeah.
You know.
Would you prefer the Tucson or the Sportage? I know it's a little bit of a tricky one because they're similar but different, but which one would you go for?
That's a really good question. And in terms of like-for-like powertrains, I feel like the Sportage was a little bit more refined, and the way it rides is much better too. So Kia's actually done a local suspension tune, whereas Hyundai didn't for the Tucson. It's got like a global tune, which I'm pretty sure is very closely aligned with the European spec. So it's sort of rides like a Volkswagen, the Tucson does. It's a bit more, it's a comfortable but errs on the firmer side, whereas the Sportage somehow on 19-inch wheels is very, very comfortable. It's got that extra layer of pliance and body control that makes it very, very comfortable. It's also very, very refined on the move. I was just driving it on a country B road before on course chip blacktop, and it was very, very quiet. Luxury levels of refinement. So between the two of them, I think that the tech and the design of the Sportage offers a bit more wow factor. And I'm for myself personally, I'm a bit torn about it because I think the Tucson is a little bit more rounded, a little bit more sleek and less out there. And I think the interior, because I like having different colored interiors, the fact that you can get a brown and a gray in the Tucson appeals to me a little bit more. And then if you want something a bit sporty, you can opt for the N-Line pack, which adds a grand or so on the Highlander, but obviously gives it quite a bit of presence. But I think that overall, I think the Sportage is probably the better car as is. And I think that if they can get enough of them, which I'm sure Crawf, you can speak to in a moment, as long as they can get enough supply of it, I reckon we could see a lot of these things on the road very soon.
I think the big thing that people need to understand with Kia's local tune is that they spend months and months and lots of dollars to get that right, and that means trying series of shocks and springs and getting the balance right between handling and ride. It's no small feat, and they do an excellent job. And the guy that does it in Australia is by the name of Graham Gumbolt. And he is an absolute expert at this. And if you talk to him, you'll get a fantastic understanding of why it's so critical to get the ride handling balance right and why Kia has really moved ahead of the game in that respect on their locally tuned cars. And you were talking about numbers. Well, basically for the next 12 months, they're probably going to get maximum of just under 1,000 Sportages a month in total. Now, what's happened recently is the US used to get their cars out of the same factory we did in Guangzhou, Korea. Now the US production has now moved back domestically onto the US soil from their Georgia plant. So that frees up more than 100,000 spots for us, although we've had to now share it with Russia, because Russia apparently want the long wheelbase version that we're getting, and they used to buy theirs out of Slovakia, and Slovakia only do the short wheelbase. And so the long wheelbase will now be sourced out of the Guangzhou factory, which where we get our stock from. So give or take, but Kia should see lots and lots, you know, many, many thousand, tens of thousands of Sportage slots open up, and that will be shared with Seltos. Because apparently Seltos has taken off like a rocket in the US, where Seoul was once the big hit for them. Seoul has dropped off, and now the Seltos has found much favor with the US audience. So just wanted to throw that in.
Interesting stuff. All right, you can head to carexpert.com.au to check out what JWO gave that car a rating and read the full review as well. Thank you, James Wong.
Thank you for having me.
There goes episode 70 of the Car Expert podcast. JWO's off and about next week. Jack, what's he up to?
Yeah, I'm a little bit jealous myself. I've been I was chatting to him about it. I'm like, oh, I just want to be you so bad. I want to travel. So Jay was going to Sydney, of all places. He's able to leave the state.
Getting on a plane? Yeah. I've never heard this before.
It's bizarre. So James is going to Sydney to have a drive of the Hyundai i20N and the Kona N, so the sporty models. It's going to be super cool. I'm really curious to see what he has to say. I reckon that Kona N is going to be freaking amazing.
It'll be a weapon.
Yeah, 100%.
Well, it 100%. Is a weapon. I believe it's faster than the i30N.
Yeah, with the all-wheel drive, I bet it does. Yeah.
Which is amazing. I've actually driven that i20N as a prototype form at Wakefield Raceway staggered at how well it drove on a racetrack, even though it was in manual form only. Mm. But I was braking so late compared to the i30N, like 50 meters difference. And virtually just a tap on the brakes and away you go again. So just that beautiful light with, you know, like that really rorty powertrain. And I think that car's going to do some really good numbers, by the way, that i20N and the Kona N for that matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, absolutely. So. And what cars have we got coming up?
Got a few different cars coming in this week. So we have a BMW 330e. And we have a Peugeot 2008 GT coming up next week. We've also got a Lexus LC500, the hybrid version, unfortunately. Not the cool V8. It's just going
to
be the hybrid.
It's
100% going to be so cool.
Still quick, by the way.
Oh, I haven't actually been in one before, but I reckon it'd be, as you said, super quick. It looks awesome. And then there's also the Land Rover Discovery Sport D200 R Dynamic SE. Goodness me, that was a mouthful. There's going to be Audi Q5 Sportback 40 TDI. And then we're also going to be getting a Ford Mustang GT manual coupe again. Yeah, it's going to be a super cool week.
Nice one. Well, if you have any questions for us or any feedback at all, our email address is podcast@carexpert.com.au. Thank you, Tony Crawford and Jack Quick.
Thanks, Mandy. Thanks, Jack. Great to see you guys.
It's good to see you again.